Franca put her hands on the sill and leaned out a little, staring at the two men. The sun on her face showed how time truly was beginning to wrinkle, stretch, and sag what he had always thought was one of the most beautiful, if not the strangest, women he had ever known. Even so, despite the advance of time, her beauty was still haunting. Dalton watched the men's hands move, gesturing as they spoke, but he could hear none of their words. With her gift, she should be able to easily hear them. Franca's face went blank. She stood so still she looked like one of the wax figures from the traveling exhibition that came through Fairfield twice a year. Dalton couldn't even tell if the woman was breathing. She finally pulled an annoyed breath.
"Can't hear a word. They're too far away to see their lips, so I can't get any help by that, but still I don't hear a thing, and I should."
Dalton looked down, close to the building, three stories below.
"What about those two?"
Franca leaned out for a look. Dalton could almost hear them himself. A chuckle rose up and an exclamation, but no more. Franca again went still. This time the breath she pulled bordered on rage.
"Nothing, and I can almost hear them without the gift."
Dalton closed the window. The anger went out of her face in a rush, and he saw something he had never before seen from her. Fear.
"Dalton, you have to get rid of that man. He must be a wizard or something. He's got me all tied up in knots."
"How do you know it's him?" She blinked twice at the question.
"Well, what else could it be? He claims to be able to eliminate magic. He's only been here a few days, and I've only had this problem a few days."
"Have you had trouble with other things, other aspects of your gift?" She turned away, wringing her hands.
"A few days ago, I made up a little spell for a woman who came to see me. Little spell so she would have her moon flow back and not be pregnant. This morning she returned and said it didn't work."
"Well, it must be a complex kind of conjuring. There must be a lot involved. I expect such things don't always work." She shook her head.
"It's always worked before."
"Perhaps you're ill. Have you felt different of late?"
"I feel exactly the same. I feel like my power is as strong as ever. It should be, but it's not.
Other charms have failed, too. I'd not let this go without testing it, thorough-like." Troubled, Dalton leaned closer.
"Franca, I don't know a lot about it, but maybe some of it is just confidence in yourself. Maybe you just have to believe you can do it for it to work again."
She glared back over her shoulder.
"Where'd you ever get such a daft notion about the gift?"
"I don't know," Dalton shrugged. "I admit I don't know a great deal about magic, but I really don't believe Stein has the gift or any magic about him. He's just not the sort. Besides, he's not even here today. He couldn't be interrupting your ability hearing those people down there. He went out to tour the countryside. He's been gone for hours." She slowly rounded on him, looking fearsome and at the same time frightened. Such opposing aspects at the same time gave him goose flesh.
"Then I fear," she whispered, "that I've simply lost my power. I'm helpless.
Franca, I'm sure." She licked her lips.
"You have Saren Rajak locked away in chains, don't you? I'd not like to think him or his lunatic followers."
"I told you before, we have him in chains. I'm not even sure he's still alive. After all this time, I doubt it. But either way, there is no need to worry about Saren Rajak." Staring off, she nodded. He touched her arm. "Franca, I'm certain your power will return. Try not to be overly concerned." Tears welled in her eyes.
"Dalton, I'm terrified."
Cautiously, he took the weeping woman in his consoling arms. She was, after all, besides being a dangerous, gifted woman, a friend. The words from the song at the feast came to mind. "Came the thieves of the charm and spell." Chapter 25. Roberta lifted her chin high in the air, stretching her neck to guardedly peer off past the brink of the cliff not far away and look out over the fertile fields of her beloved Narif Valley far below. Freshly plowed fields were a deep, rich brown among breathtakingly bright green carpets of new crops, and the darker, verdant pastures where livestock, looking like tiny slow ants, cropped at tender new grass. The Damar River meandered through it all, sparkling in the early morning sunshine, escorted along its route by a gathering of dark green trees, as if they'd come to watch the river's showy parade. Whenever she went up in the woods near Nesting Cliff,
She had herself a look from afar, just to see the pretty valley below. After allowing herself that brief look, she always lowered her eyes to the shaded forest floor at her feet, the leaf litter and mossy stretches among dappled sunlight, where the ground was firm and comforting. Roberta shifted the sack, slung over her shoulder, and moved on. As she maneuvered through the clear patches among the huckleberry and hawthorn, stepped on stones set like islands among dark crevices and holes, and ducked under low pine boughs and alder limbs, she flipped aside with her walking stick a fern here or a low-spreading balsam branch there, looking, always looking, as she moved along. She spied a vase-shaped yellow cap and stooped for a look. Chanterelle, she was pleased to see, and not the poisonous jack-o'-lantern. Most folk favored the smooth yellow chanterelle mushroom for its nut-like flavor. She hooked the stem with a finger and plucked it up. Before sticking the prize in her sack, she ran her thumb over the feather-like gills just for the pleasure of the soft feel. The mountain she searched for her mushrooms was only a small mountain compared to the others jutting up all around, and but for nesting cliff, reassuringly round with trails, a few made by man but most made by animal, crisscrossing the gentle wooded slopes. It was the kind of woods her aging muscles and increasingly aching bones favored. It was said a person could see the ocean far off to the south from many of the taller mountains. She'd often heard it to be an inspiring sight. Many people went up there once every year or two just to view the splendor of the Creator by what he'd wrought. Some of those trails took a person along the scruffy edges of cliffs and scree and such. Some folk even tended herds of goats up on those steep and rocky slopes. But for a journey when she was a small child, when her pa, rest his soul, took them off to Fairfield, for what she could no longer remember, she had never even been up there. Roberta was content to remain near the alluvial land. Unlike a lot of other folk, Roberta never climbed the higher mountains. She was afraid of high places. Up higher yet, in the highlands above, were far worse places, like the wasteland up above where the warfer birds nested. There was nothing in that desolate place, not a blade of grass nor a sprig of scrub brush, except those paca plants, growing in that poison swampy water. Nothing else up there but the vast stretches of dark, rocky, sandy soil, and a few bleached bones, as she heard tell. Like another world, those who'd seen it said. Silent, but for the wind that dragged the dark, sandy dirt into mounds that shifted over time, always moving on as if they were looking for something but never finding it. The lower mountains, like the ones she hunted for mushrooms, were beautiful, lush places, rounder and softer mostly, and except for nesting cliff, not so steep and rocky. She liked it where it was full of trees and critters and growing things of all sorts. The deer trails she searched stayed away from the edges she didn't like and never went very close to nesting cliff, as it was called because the falcons liked to nest there. She liked the deep woods where her mushrooms grew. Roberta collected mushrooms to sell at market, some fresh, some dried, some pickled, and others fixed in various ways. Most folk called her the Mushroom Lady and knew her by no other name. Sold at market, the mushrooms helped earn her family some trading money for the things that made life easier. Needles and thread, some ready-made cloth, buckles and buttons, a lamp, oil, salt, sugar, cinnamon, nuts. Things to help a body have an easier time of it. Easier for her family and especially for her four grandchildren still living. Roberta's mushrooms provided all those things to supplement what they grew or raised themselves. Of course, they made good eating, too. She did like best the mushrooms that grew in the forests up on the mountain, rather than those down in the valley. Touched as they were up there by clouds so much of the time, the mushrooms grew well in the damp conditions. She always thought there were none better than those from up on the mountain, and many folks sought her out just for her mountain mushrooms. Roberta had her secret places, too, where she found the best ones every year. The big pockets in her apron were plump and full with them, as was the sack over her shoulder. Because it was still early in the year, she'd mostly found heavy clusters of the tawny-colored oyster mushrooms. Their fleshy, tender caps were best for dipping in egg and frying, so she'd sell them fresh. But she'd been lucky and would be setting out chanterelles to dry as well as offering fresh. She found a goodly number of pheasant's backs, too, and they'd be best pickled if she wanted to get the highest price. It was too early for woolly velvet in most places, even though it would be common enough later on in the summer. But she'd gone to one of her special spots where there were a lot of pine stumps, and she'd found some of the ochre-colored woolly velvet used to make dye.
Roberta had even found a rotting birch with a cluster of smoky brown polypores. The kidney-shaped mushroom were favored by cooks to keep a fire blazing and by men to strop their razors. Leaning on her walking stick, Roberta bent over a harmless-looking brownish mushroom. It had a ring on the off-white stalk. She saw that the yellowish gills were just starting to turn a rust color. It was that time of year for this mushroom, too. Grunting her displeasure, she let the deadly gallerina be and moved on. Back under the spreading limbs of an oak, as big around as her two oxen shoulder to shoulder when they were yoked up, she plucked up three good-sized, spicy chanterelles. The spicy variety grew almost exclusively under oak wood. They had already turned from yellow to orange, so they'd be choice eating. Roberta knew where she was, but was off her usual path, so she'd never seen the huge oak before. When she'd seen the tree's crown, she knew that with all the shade it provided, it would be a good spot for mushrooms. She was not disappointed. At the base of the oak, around part of the trunk where it came up from the ground, she was delighted to see a bunch of small pipes, or beef vein, as some folk called them, because the standing tubes were sometimes a vivid red, like a whole passel of veins bunched together and cut off even-like. These, though, were pinkish, streaked with just a bit of red. Roberta preferred the name small pipes, but she still didn't hold much favor with them. Some folk, though, bought them for their tart taste, and they were on the rare side, so they brought a decent price. Under the tree in the deep shade was a ring of spirit bells, so called because of their bell-like tops. They weren't poisonous, but because of the bitter taste and woody texture, no one liked them. Worse, though, people thought that anyone stepping inside the ring would be bewitched, so folks generally didn't even want to see the lovely little spirit bells. Roberta had been walking through spirit bell rings since she was a toddler when her mother would take her along mushrooming. Since she held no favor with such superstition about her beloved mushrooms, she stepped through the ring of spirit bells, imagining she heard their delicate chimes, and gathered up the small pipes. One of the spreading branches of the oak grew down low enough to make a seat. Big around as her ample waist, it was comfortable enough and dry enough for a good sit. Roberta slipped her sack to the ground. She sighed with relief as she laid her weary bones back against another branch, which turned up at just the right angle to rest her shoulders and head against. The tree seemed to cup her in its sheltering hand. Daydreaming as she was, she thought it was part of the dream when she heard a whisper that sounded like her name. It was a pleasing, low, warm sound, more a feeling of good things and pleasant thoughts than a word. The second time, she knew it wasn't part of her daydream, and she was sure it was her name being spoken, but in a fashion somehow more intimate than a mere spoken word. The thing was, the way it was spoken strummed the strings of her heart, like the spirit's own music it was, all lovely with kindness, compassion, and warmth. It made her sigh, it made her happy. It fell across her like warm sunlight on a chill day. The third time, she sat up to look, longing to see the source of such a touching voice. Even as she moved, she felt like she was in one of her daydreams, all peaceful and content. The forest all about seemed to sparkle, and the morning sun seemed to glow. Roberta let out a small gasp when she saw him not far away. She'd never seen him before, but she'd always known him, it seemed. She realized he was a familiar friend, a comfort, a partner from her mind since youth, though she never really gave it much thought before. He was the one who had always been there with her, it seemed. The one she always thought about when she was daydreaming, the face without definition, yet one she knew well. Now she realized he was as real as she had always imagined when she kissed him in her fancies, which she had done ever since she was young enough to know that a kiss was something more than your mother gave you before bed. His were kisses given in bed, all warm and ardent. She'd never thought he was real, but now she was sure she'd always known he was. As he stood there gazing into her eyes, how could he not be real? His tumble of hair swept back from his glorious face, showing his warm smile, though she thought it puzzling that she couldn't say just what he looked like. Yet at the same time, she knew his face as well as she knew her own. And she knew his every thought, just as he knew every thought and longing of hers. He was her soul's true mate. She knew his thoughts. She didn't need his name. That she didn't know his name was only proof to her that they were connected on a spiritual level that transcended words. And now he had stepped out of the mist of that spiritual world, needing to be with her, just as she needed to be with him. He held his perfect hand out to her. His smile was knowing and loving and kind. He understood her.
understood things about her that no one else could ever understand. It made her weep with joy that he understood her so, understood her soul. His hand opened to her, calling her with his need. Roberta reached for his hand, her heart calling out her need of him. She seemed almost to float above the ground, her feet touched like dandelion fluff drifting on a breath. Her body floated like weed in water as she stretched out to him, stretched out for his embrace. The closer she got, the warmer she felt. Not warm as if from the sun on her face, but warm like a child's arms around her neck, warm like her mother's arms around her, like a lover's smile, like a lover's sweet kiss. Her whole life came down to this, to needing to be in his arms, feeling his tender embrace, needing to whisper her yearning because she knew he would understand, needing the breath from his lips on her ear, telling her he understood. She burned to whisper her love, to have him whisper his. She needed nothing in life so much as she needed to be in those arms she knew so well. Her muscles were no longer weary, her bones no longer ached. She was no longer old. The years had slipped away from her like clothes slipping from lovers, shedding encumbrances in order to get down to the bare essence of their being. Because of him alone, she was again in the winsome bloom of youth where everything was possible. His arm floated out to her, his need for her as great as hers for him. She stretched for his hand, but it seemed farther away, and she stretched more, but it was more distant still. Panic raced through her as she feared he would be gone before she could at last touch him. She felt as if she were swimming in honey and could make no progress. Her whole life she had longed to touch him. Her whole life she had longed to tell him. Her whole life she had longed to have her soul join with his. But now he was drifting from her. Roberta, her legs heavy like lead, leaped through the spring sunshine, through the sweet air, racing to her lover's arms. And yet he was farther still. Both his arms lifted to her. She could feel his need. She ached to comfort him, to shelter him from hurt, to soothe his strife. He could feel those longings in her, and cried out her name that she might be strengthened in her effort to reach him. The sound of her name on his lips made her heart lift with joy, lift with a terrible pang of need to return such passion as he put into her name. She wept to know his name now, that she might put it to her undying love. With all her might she stretched out to him. She put her entire being into her reckless lunge for him, forsaking all care but her fierce need to reach him. Roberta cried her nameless love, cried her need, as she reached for his fingers. His arms spread to take her into his loving embrace. As she rushed into those arms, the sun sparkled all about. The warm wind lifted her hair, ruffled her dress. As he cried her name with such beauty it made her ache, her arms spread wide to take him at last into her embrace. She felt as if she were floating endlessly through the air toward him, the sun on her face, the breeze in her hair. But it was all right, because now she was where she wanted to be, with him. At that moment there was no more perfect time in the whole of her life, no more perfect feeling in the whole of her existence, no more perfect love in the whole of the world. She heard the perfect chimes of those feelings ring out with the glory of it all. Her heart nearly burst as she at last plunged into his embrace in one wild rush, screaming out her need, her love, her completion, wanting only to know his name so she might give everything of herself to him. His glowing smile was for her and her alone. His lips were for her and her alone. She closed that last bit of space toward him, longing to at last kiss the love of her life, the mate to her soul, the one and the only true passion in all of life. His lips were there at last as she fell into his outstretched arms, into his embrace, into his perfect kiss. In that flawless instant, when her lips were just touching his, she saw through him, just beyond him, the merciless, unyielding valley floor hurtling up toward her, and she knew at last his name. Death. Chapter 26. "There," Richard said, leaning close so Caitlin could sight down his arm as he pointed off toward the horizon. "See that really dark fleck of cloud in front of the lighter part?" He waited for her nod. "Under that, and just a bit to the right." Standing amid a seemingly endless sea of nearly waist-high grass, Caitlin straightened and held a hand to her brow to shield her eyes from the morning light. "I still can't see him." Her frustration came out as a sigh. "But I've never been able to see distant things as well as you." "I don't see him either," Kara said. Richard again checked over his shoulder, scanning the empty grassland all around to make sure they weren't about to be surprised by someone sneaking up while they watched the approach of this one man. He saw no other threat. You will, soon enough. He reached over to check that his sword was clear in its scabbard, only realizing he was doing so when he found the sword absent from his left hip. He instead pulled his bow from his shoulder and knocked an arrow. There had been countless times he had wished to be rid of the Sword of Truth and its attendant magic, inasmuch as it brought forth from within himself things he abhorred. The sword's magic could fuse with those feelings into a lethal wrath. Zed, when he first gave Richard the sword, told him it was only a tool. Over time, he had come to comprehend Zed's advice. Still, it was a horrifying tool to have to use. It was up to the one wielding the sword to govern not simply the weapon, but himself. Understanding that part of it, among other things, was essential to using the weapon as it was intended. And it was intended for none but a true seeker of truth. Richard shuddered to think of that contrivance of magic in the wrong hands. He thanked the good spirits that, if he couldn't have it with him, it was at least safe. Below distant, billowing clouds, their interiors glowing in the morning light, colors from a deep yellow to an unsettling violet that marked the violence of the storms contained within, the man continued to approach. Lightning, silent at this distance, flashed and flickered inside the colossal clouds, illuminating hidden canyons, valley walls, and seething peaks. Compared with other places he had been, the sky and clouds above the flat plains somehow appeared impossibly grand. He guessed it was because from horizon to horizon there was nothing, no mountains, no trees, nothing, to interrupt the drama of the vast vault of stage overhead. The departing storm clouds had only finally moved on eastward before dawn, taking with them the rain that had so vexed them when with the mud people, their first day of traveling, and their first miserable cold night without a fire. Traveling in the rain was unpleasant. In its wake, the rain had left the three of them irritable. Like him, Caelan was worried about Zed and Anne and troubled by what the lurk might bring next. It was also frustrating to have to undertake a long journey when they were in such a rush and it was so vitally important, rather than return to Adendrill in short order through the Slough. Richard was almost willing to take the risk. Almost. With Kara, though, it seemed something more was disturbing her. She was as disagreeable as a cat in a sack. He wasn't eager to reach in and get scratched. He figured that if it was truly important, she would tell them. Added to all that, Richard was unsettled by not having his sword with him when there was trouble about. He feared the lurk trying to harm Caelan while he was unable to protect her. Even without the trouble caused by the Sisters of the Dark, there were any number of ordinary dangers for a confessor, any number of people who would, were she defenseless, like to settle what they viewed as injustices. With the spell eroding magic, sooner or later her confessor's power would be gone, and she would be without its ability to protect her. He needed to be able to protect her, but without the sword he feared being inadequate to the task. Every time he reached for his sword and it wasn't there, he felt an emptiness he couldn't express in words. It was as if part of him was missing. Even so, Richard was, for some reason, uneasy about going to Adendrill. Something about it felt wrong. He rationalized it as worry about leaving Zed when he was so weak and vulnerable, but Zed had made it clear there was no choice. Up until he had spotted the approaching stranger, their second day had been looking sunny, dry, and more agreeable. Richard put some tension to the bowstring. After their encounter with the chicken thing, or rather the lurk, and with so much at stake, he didn't intend to let anyone get close unless he knew them to be a friend. Richard frowned over at Caelan. You know, I think my mother once told me a story or something about a cat named Lurk. Holding a fistful of hair to keep the breeze from blowing it across her face, Caelan frowned back. That's odd. Are you sure? No. She died when I was young. It's hard to remember if I'm really remembering or just fooling myself into thinking I am. What do you think you remember? Caelan asked. Richard stretched the bowstring to test it and then relaxed it part way. I think I fell down and skinned a knee or something, and she was trying to make me laugh, you know, to make me forget my hurt. I think she just that one time told me how when she was little, her mother told her a story of a cat that lurked about pouncing on things, and so earned the name Lurk. I swear I remember her laughing and asking if I didn't think that was a funny name. Yes, very funny, Kara said, making clear she thought it wasn't. With a finger, she lifted the point of his arrow, and thus his bow, in the direction of the danger she seemed to think he was ignoring. What made you think of that now? Caelan asked. Richard pointed with his chin toward the approaching man. I was considering the man being out here, You know, thinking of what other dangers might be lurking about. And when you thought of all these dangers lurking about, Kara said, did you also decide to just stand around and let them all come to attack you as they wish? Ignoring Kara, Richard tilted his head toward the man. You must see him now. No, I still don't see where it is. Wait. Hand to her brow, Keelan rose up onto her tiptoes, as if that would help her see better. There he is. I see him now. I think we should conceal ourselves in the grass and then pounce on him, Kara said.
He saw us at the same time I saw him, Richard said. He knows we're here. We couldn't surprise him.
At least there is only one, Kara yawned. We will have no trouble.
Kara, standing the middle watch, hadn't wakened him as early as she was supposed to for his turn at watch. She had left him sleeping an extra hour at least. Middle watch, too, usually got less sleep. Richard checked over his shoulder again. You may see only one, but there are a number more, a dozen at least. Kaylin put her hand back to her forehead to shield her eyes. I don't see any more. She looked to the sides and behind.
I only see this one, are you sure?
Yes. When I first saw him and he saw me, he left the others and came alone toward us. They still wait. Kara snatched up a pack. She shoved Kaylin's shoulder, then Richard's.
Let's go. We can outdistance them until we're out of sight and then hide. If they follow, we will take them by surprise and put a quick end to the pursuit.
Richard returned the shove. Would you just settle down? He's coming alone so as not to draw any arrows. If it was an attack, he would have brought all his men at once. We will wait.
Kara folded her arms and pressed her lips together in a bit of ire. She seemed to be beyond her usual protective self. Whether or not she was ready to tell him, they were going to have to talk to her and find out what her problem was. Maybe Kaylin would have some luck. The man lifted his arms, waving at them in a friendly gesture. Suddenly, recognizing the man, Richard took his hand from the bowstring and returned the greeting.
It's Chandelin. It wasn't long until Kaylin waved her arm, too.
You're right, it is Chandelin.
Richard returned his arrow to the quiver hung on his belt. I wonder what he's doing out here.
When you were still searching the chickens gathered together in the buildings, Kaylin said, he went to check on some of his men on far patrol. He said they had encountered some heavily armed people. His men were worried about the behavior of the strangers.
They were hostile.
No. Kaylin pushed her damp hair back over her shoulder. But Chandelin's men said they had a calm about them when approached. That troubled him.
Richard nodded as he watched Chandelin's approach, seeing that he brought no weapons except a belt knife. As was the custom, he didn't smile as he trotted up to them. Until proper greetings were exchanged, mud people didn't usually smile when they encountered even friends on the plains. With a grim expression, Chandelin quickly slapped Richard, Kaylin, and Kara. Though he had run most of the way, he seemed hardly winded as he greeted them by their titles.
Strength to the mother confessor, strength to Richard with the temper.
He added a nod to his spoken greeting of Kara. She was a protector the same as he. All three returned the slap and wished him their strength.
Where are you going? Chandelin asked.
There's trouble, Richard said as he offered his waterskin. We have to get back to Aidendrill. Chandelin accepted the waterskin as he let out a grumble of worry.
The chicken that is not a chicken?
In a way, yes, Kaylin told him. Turns out it was magic conjured by the Sisters of the Dark Jigang is holding prisoner.
Lord Raoul used his magic to destroy the chicken that was not a chicken, Kara put in.
Chandelin, looking relieved to hear her news, took a swig of water.
Then why must you go to Aidendrill?
Richard rested the end of his bow on the ground and gripped the other end.
The spell the Sisters cast endangers everyone and everything of magic. It's making Zed and Anne weak. They're waiting back at your village. In Aidendrill, we hope to unleash magic to counter the Sisters of the Dark, and then Zed will be strong enough to put everything right again. The Sisters' magic made the chicken thing that killed Junie. Until we can get to Aidendrill, no one is safe.
Having listened carefully, Chandelin finally replaced the stopper and handed back the waterskin.
Then you must soon be on your way to do what only you can,
he checked over his shoulder. Now that Chandelin had identified himself, the others were approaching.
But my men have met strangers who must see you first.
Richard hooked his bow back over his shoulder as he peered off into the distance. He couldn't make out the people.
So who are they?
Chandelin stole a glance at Kaylin before directing his answer to Richard.
We have an old saying, it is best to hold your tongue around the cook, or you may end up in the pot with the chicken that ate her dinner greens. It seemed to Richard that Chandolin was trying very hard to keep from looking at Kalin's puzzled expression. Although Richard couldn't fathom the reason, he thought he understood the figure of speech, odd as it was. He thought maybe it was a bad translation. The approaching people weren't far off. Chandolin, having had one of his trusted hunters killed by the Lurk, would want Richard and Kalin to do what they could to stop the enemy. He would not insist they delay their journey unless he had a good reason. If it's important for them to see us, then let's go. Chandolin caught Richard's arm. They only asked to see you. Perhaps you wish to go alone? Then you could be on your way. Why would Richard want to go alone? Kalin asked, suspicion bubbling up in her voice. She then added something in the Mud People's language which Richard didn't understand. Chandolin lifted his hands, showing her his empty palms, as if to say he held no weapon and wished no fight. For some reason, he seemed to want no part of whatever was going on. Maybe I should... Richard closed his mouth when Kalin's suspicious glower shifted to him. He cleared his throat. I was going to say we have no secrets. Richard hefted his gear. Kalin is always welcome at my side. We have no time to waste. Let's go. Chandolin nodded and turned to lead them to their fate. Richard thought he saw the man roll his eyes in a don't-say-I-didn't-warn-you fashion. Richard could see 10 of Chandolin's hunters following behind the 7 oncoming travelers, with another 3 hunters winged out distantly to each side, hemming in the strangers without being overtly threatening. The Mud People hunters seemed merely to accompany and guide the strangers, but Richard knew they were ready to strike at any sign of hostility. Armed outsiders on Mud People land were like tinder before a lightning storm. Richard hoped this storm, too, would move away and leave sunny skies to follow. Kalin, Kara, and Richard hurried behind Chandolin through the wet new grass. Chandolin's men were the first line of defense for the Mud People. That the Mud People's land was given a wide berth by almost everyone spoke to their fighting ferocity. Yet Chandolin's skilled and deadly hunters, now turned escorts, elicited no more than detached indifference from the 6 men in loose flaxen clothes. Something about that indifference at being surrounded tickled at Richard's memory. As the approaching group got close enough for Richard to suddenly recognize them, he missed a step. It took a few moments of scrutiny before he could believe what he was seeing. He at last understood the stranger's fearless indifference to Chandolin's men. He couldn't imagine what these people were doing away from their own homeland. Each man was dressed the same and carried the same weapons. Richard knew only one by name, but knew them all. These people were dedicated to a purpose laid down by their lawgivers thousands of years before, those wizards in the Great War who had taken their homeland and created the Valley of the Lost to separate the New World from the Old. Their black-handled swords, with their distinctive curved blades that widened toward clipped points, remained in their scabbards. One end of a cord was tied to a ring on the pommel of each man's sword. The other end of the cord looped around the swordsman's neck as a precaution against losing the weapon in battle. Additionally, each of the 6 carried spears and a small, round, unadorned shield. Richard had seen women clothed and armed the same and committed to the same purpose, but this time they were all men. For these men, practice with their swords was an art form. They practiced that art by moonlight, after the day did not provide them all the time they wished. Using their swords was near to a religious devotion, and they went about their blade work with pious commitment. These men were blade masters. 7th, the woman, was dressed differently and not armed, at least not in the conventional sense. Richard wasn't good at judging such things by sight, but a quick calculation told him she had to be at least 6 months pregnant. A thick mass of long black hair framed a lovely face, her presence giving her features, especially her dark eyes, a certain edginess. Unlike the men's loose outfits of simple cloth, she wore a knee-length dress of finely woven flax, dyed a rich earth color, and gathered at the waist with a buckskin belt. The ends of the belt were decorated with roughly cut gemstones. Up the outside of each arm and across the shoulders of the dress was a row of little strips of different colored cloth. Each was knotted on through a small hole beneath a corded band, and each, Richard knew, would have been tied on by a supplicant. It was a prayer dress. Each of the little colored strips, when they fluttered in the breeze, meant to send a prayer to the good spirits. The dress was worn only by their spirit woman. Richard's mind raced with possibilities as to why these people would have traveled so far from their homeland. He could come up with nothing good and a lot that was unpleasant. Richard had halted. Kaelin waited to his left, Kara to his right, and Chandelin to the right of her. Ignoring everyone else, the men in the loose clothes all laid their spears on the ground beside themselves as they went to their knees before Richard. They bowed forward, touching their foreheads to the ground, and stayed there. The woman stood silently regarding him. Her dark eyes bore the timeless look Richard had often seen in others, Sister Verna, Shoda, the witch woman, Anne, and Kaelin, among others. That timeless look was the mark of the gift. As she gazed into Richard's eyes with a look that seemed to hint at wisdom he would never grasp, a ghost of a smile touched her lips. Without a word, she went to her knees at the head of the six men accompanying her. She touched her forehead to the ground and then kissed the toe of his boot.
"Kaharin,"
she whispered reverently. Richard reached down and tugged on the shoulder of her dress, urging her up.
"Do Shailu, it pleases my heart to see you are well, but what are you doing here?"
She rose up before him, a heartening, handsome smile widening across her face. She bent forward and kissed his cheek.
"I have come to see you, of course, Richard, Seeker, Kaharin, husband."
Chapter 27
"Husband,"
Richard heard Kaelin say in a rising tone of concern. With a jolt of astonished shock that nearly took him from his feet and did take his breath, Richard abruptly recalled Du Shalu's account of her people's old law. The dire implications staggered him. At the time, he had dismissed her adamant assertions as either irrational conviction or perhaps misconceptions about their history. Now this old ghost had unexpectedly returned to haunt him.
"Husband?"
Kaelin repeated, a little louder, a little more insistently. Her dark eyes turned to Kaelin, as if annoyed she had to take them from Richard.
"Yes, husband. I am Du Shailu, wife of the Kaharin, Richard, the Seeker."
Du Shailu rubbed her hand over her pronounced belly. Her look of annoyance passed, and she beamed with pride.
"I bear his child."
"Leave it to me, Mother Confessor," Kara said.
There was no mistaking the resolute menace in her voice.
"This time I will take care of it."
Kara yanked the knife from Chandelin's belt and lunged for the woman. Richard was quicker. He spun to Kara and shoved the tips of his stiffened fingers against her upper chest. It not only halted her forward progress, but drove her back 3 paces. He had enough problems without her causing more. He shoved her again and drove her back another 3, and then another 3 away from the group of people. Richard twisted the knife from her grip.
"Now you listen to me. You don't know the first thing about this woman."
"I know
you know nothing. Listen to me. You are fighting the last war. This is not Nadine. This is nothing like Nadine."
His quiescent fury had at last erupted. With a cry of unleashed rage, Richard heaved the knife at the ground. The force drove it beneath the grass mat, burying it completely into the soil of the plains. Kaelin laid her hand on the back of his shoulder.
"Richard, calm down. What's this about? What's going on?"
Richard raked his fingers back through his hair. Clenching his jaw, he glanced about and saw the men still on their knees.
"Gian, the rest of you, get off your knees, get up."
The men rose up at once. Du Shailu waited passively, patiently. Chandelin and his men backed off. The mud people had named him Richard with the temper, and, while not surprised, looked to think it best to give ground. Chandelin and his men had no idea his anger was for what had killed one of them, had most likely, he realized, killed 2 of them, and would surely kill more. Kaelin regarded him with a look of concern.
"Richard, calm down and get a hold of yourself. Who are these people?"
He couldn't seem to slow his breathing, or his heart, or unclench his fists, or stop his racing thoughts. Everything seemed to be reeling out of control. Fears laid to rest seemed to have unshackled themselves and suddenly sprung up to snare him. He should have seen it before. He cursed himself for missing it. But there had to be a way to stop it. He had to think. He had to stop fearing things that had not yet happened and think of a way to prevent them from coming to be. He realized it had already happened. He now had to think of the solution. Kaelin lifted his chin to look into his eyes.
"Richard, answer me. Who are these people?"
He pressed a hand to his forehead in frustrated rage.
"The Baka Banmana. It means those without masters."
We now have a Kaharin. We are no longer the Bakaban Mana,
Du Shailu said from not far away.
We are now the Bakatau Mana.
Not really comprehending Du Shailu's explanation, Halen turned her attention once more to Richard. This time her voice had a razor's edge to it. Why is she saying you are her husband? His mind had already galloped so far off down another road, he had to concentrate for a moment to understand what Kaelin was asking. She didn't realize the implications. To Richard, Kaelin's question seemed insignificant past history in the face of the future looming before them. He impatiently tried to wave away her concern.
Kaelin, it's not what you think.
She licked her lips and took a breath.
Fine.
Her green eyes fixed on him.
So why don't you just explain it to me, then?
It was not a question. Richard instead asked his own.
Don't you see? Overwhelmed by impatience, he pointed at Du Shailu. It's the old law. By the old law, she is my wife. At least, she thinks she is.
Richard pressed his fingertips to his temples. His head was throbbing.
We are in a great deal of trouble, he muttered.
You are, anyway, Kara said.
Kara, Halen said through her teeth. That's enough.
She turned back to him.
Richard, what are you talking about? What's going on?
Accounts from Kolo's journal echoed through his mind. He couldn't seem to order his thoughts enough to put all the tumbling elements into words. The world was shredding apart. She was asking him yesterday's questions. Since he saw it so clearly looming before them, he couldn't comprehend why Kaelin wouldn't comprehend the danger, too.
Don't you see?
Richard's mind picked madly through the shadowy possibilities as he tried to decide what to do next. Time was slipping away. He didn't even know how much they had.
I see you got her pregnant,
Kara said. Richard turned to glare on the Mord Sith.
After all we have been through, Kara, do you think no more of me?
Looking galled, Kara folded her arms and didn't answer.
Do the math, Halen told Kara.
Richard would have been a prisoner of the Mord Sith, far off at the People's Palace in Dahara back when this woman got pregnant. Unlike the Ajeel Richard wore out of respect for the two women who had died protecting him, Kaelin wore the Ajeel of Denna, the Mord Sith who had, at the behest of Darkin Rall, captured Richard and tortured him nearly to death. Denna had decided to take Richard as her mate, but she had never once implied it was a marriage. To Denna, it was just another way to torture and humiliate him. In the end, Richard forgave Denna for what she had done to him. Denna, knowing he was going to kill her in order to escape, gave him her Ajeel and asked him to remember her as having been more in life than simply Mord Sith. She had asked him to share her last breath of life. It had been through Denna that Richard had come to understand and empathize with these women, and by so doing he had been the only one ever to have escaped a Mord Sith. Richard was surprised at Kaelin already having done the math. He would not have expected her to doubt him. He was wrong. She seemed to read his thoughts in his eyes.
It's just something you do without thinking, she whispered. All right?
Richard, please, tell me what's going on.
You're a confessor. You know how different arrangements can constitute marriage to different peoples. Except for you, confessors always picked their mates for reasons of their own, reasons other than love, and then took them with their power before wedding them. The man had no say.
The man a confessor singled out to be her husband was selected for little more reason than his value as breeding stock. Since her power would destroy the man she picked, love, despite what she might wish, had never been an option for a confessor. A confessor chose a man for the qualities he would contribute to her daughter. Where I came from, Richard went on, parents often chose who their children would wed. A father would one day tell his child, this will be your husband or this will be your wife. Different people have different ways and different laws.
Halen cast a furtive glance at Du Shailu.
Her gaze pausing twice, once on Du Shailu's face and once on her belly. When Kaelin's gaze returned to him, her eyes had turned brutally cold.
So tell me about her laws.
Richard didn't think Kaelin was aware that she was stroking the dark stone on the delicate gold necklace Shota had given her. The witch woman had appeared unexpectedly at their wedding, and Richard remembered well her words to them.